I'm Terry Thornton. I'm so glad you're here. I think most of you know, but Tuesday Evenings is a weekly series, and we're about halfway through. I encourage you to get online and see the rest of the lineup. Next week, we have artist Emily Jassir, who was the recipient of the Golden Lion at the 52nd Venice Biennale, and the recipient of the 2008 Hugo Boss Prize. She's going to be here to present her ideas and works, which often pertain to transformation, questions of translation, resistance, and the logic of the archive. Jassir really is a very interesting and complex artist, as you might can tell from that description. And I think the presentation next week holds a great deal of promise. So I invite you to come back next Tuesday. Tonight, we are thrilled to have Tom Sachs with us. For some, this is a long time coming in that we have followed Tom's work and discussed his ideas since we first discovered it. For some of us, that might have been one of his films, such as Tin Bullets or At Speroni Westwater show several years back, or Tom Sachs' space program Mars at Park Avenue Armory in New York in 2012, which was amazing. Well, thanks to the Contemporary Austin, which is now showing Tom Sachs' Boombox Retrospective 1999 to 2015, which opened in January, Tom was sort of in the neighborhood for what seems like a whole lot of exhibition and extracurricular programming that is going on in Austin at the same time as South by Southwest. And he's been there for the past week, and as I understand it, showed a film, his film last night, did a zine signing on Sunday. I know some of you made the trip, and others are still planning to do so. So we're very thrilled to have him here tonight and appreciate Austin for the gift. For anyone new to Tom Sachs, his work, Tom is a sculptor who lives in New York, where he has the studio, which has been referred to as, which he has referred to as a teaching hospital of sorts, and which is the source of the aforementioned Tin Bullets, which is a type of rules of operation post-industrial kind of film. For those, it's made for those who work there, and is generously available to the rest of us on the website. Tom is probably best known for his elaborate recreations of various modern icons, all of them masterpieces of engineering and design. I was really interested to learn that in 1987, Tom studied at the Architectural Association in London, which is not surprising given the work, and which is affirmed with Tom's inclusion in the 2012 Architectural Venice Biennale. And, of course, within art, his exhibition record is both extensive and, of course, impressive. Recent solo shows and projects include Tom Sachs' Nuggets that opened last week at the Laura Reynolds Gallery in Austin, concurrent with his retrospective, which I mentioned. American Handmade Painting at Gallery Thaddeus Ropach in Paris in 2014. Nautical Challenge and Other Voodoo at the Baldwin Gallery in Aspen, where he also received the Aspen Award for Art in 2012, and Work, in all capital letters, at Speroni Westwater in New York in 2011. He was also included in the 2013 Lyon Biennale, and you can find Tom's work in museums as well as other public and private collections across the world, including the Guggenheim in New York, the NASA Permanent Collection in D.C., the Art Institute of Chicago, the Centre Pompidou in Paris, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And this could, of course, go on and on and on, but I know why you're here, so please join me in welcoming Tom Sachs.
Hi.
Hi.
Cell phone's off.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I thought I'd just show some pictures and talk about them, and then we could do some questions. I'm going to just try and go fast. And we'll just try and get into it, and I'll just tell you a little bit about my life. Important that You understand my work as being an expression of my life, and that some of the objects you'll see here are have questionable authenticity. For example, this camera I made when I was 10 years old, I made it for my father. It's a Nikon FM2, which is the status Vietnam service camera. And my dad couldn't afford it, so he wound up with a Olympus OM-1, basically the same camera, but just a little less expensive. And I made this for him as a present. I think it wasn't special. It wasn't a prodigy or anything, but it was a really clear expression of the culture from where I come from. And that even growing up, there was a sort of a status identity happening in my community. I didn't really get into the religious training that was thrust upon me, but I realized that the ritual in our family was consumerism, was the new car, the new clothes. If I saved up my allowance, could I get a CB Sports ski jacket, dad's new used BMW, and of course now film cameras are obsolete, but it was important. I think it'll make more sense in a little bit when you skip fast forward 30 years to when I moved to New York in the 90s, and the police started carrying plastic Glocks, so these beautifully crafted 9mm pistols that were mostly plastic. And men have guns and cameras not because they like to shoot pictures or people or animals, but because they love to hold machines in their hands. And I think that's why a lot of men have guns and cameras. But at the time, I was also working at Barney's New York as a display elf. And I was very involved in the fashion community. And so I kind of synthesized this Tiffany Glock out of cardboard. I had been at the Met, and I saw that Tiffany collaborated with Smith & Wesson, and there's a Tiffany's silver gun there. And, of course, the Glock was famous for being packaged in its own Tupperware container. So I thought that the packaging and the plastic all kind of came together. But really, more than anything, it was my desire, in the same way that my dad wanted this camera, and I made one for him. I made a gun for myself out of cardboard. And then I got money and I went to Kmart and bought a gun, just like that. I'm going to go back, sorry, it's going over the place. Similarly, this is an Hermes value meal. It's made of Hermes packaging. So this, in a sense, is made in France because the cardboard's made in France, but I cut it up and assembled it in New York. But it's not painted Hermes. It's made of the packaging. So you can imagine the bills that I have to pay in order to get that much packaging at home. But I'm going to brag for a second about the Chanel Guillotine Breakfast Nook. And this, and I'm bragging because this is actually in the Pompidou Center permanent collection in Paris, France. And the last man executed by guillotine was in 1977. Which is an important year for us because it kind of represents the year of punk. It's the year of the Clash and of the Sex Pistols. And this is a real guillotine. It's kind of for the urban couple who's got everything. And it's real. It cuts heads off. And it's got little stools. But it's this was kind of a case of a Don't ask permission, just beg for forgiveness. And I know a question that comes up is, do you collaborate with brands? And with just really one exception, I don't. And this was a case of me making this project at the right time in the late 90s. I think there's an artist named Rhonda Lieberman who made a Chanel menorah that's at the Jewish Museum in New York City. And next to it is a framed cease and desist letter from Chanel, and that was probably 92 or something, just a few years. But tides change, and art's much more fashionable right now. So when I left school, I really wanted a Mondrian, and I thought, I loved Mondrian. It's still really one of my favorites, and I thought, what's it going to take for me to get a Mondrian? I thought, okay, I just have to go down to Wall Street, dedicate my life to the pursuit of money, and then I can go buy one. And then I thought that the kind of compromises that it would take for me to do that, it wasn't something I was willing to do. I didn't want to spend all my time making abstract wealth so that I could transform it into the concrete value of art. So I wound up going to the Museum of Modern Art, studying Broadway Boogie Woogie, making my own version of it out of gaffer's tape, which is a material that I'm close with, duct tape, gaffer's tape. It's not paint, it's colored tape. And I found that, I think that I probably spent more time with that painting than someone like Eli Brode, who owns it, because he's spending his time doing business to manage the resources to obtain such a thing. Now, you could say, well, yeah, but mine's not real. And I could say, well, it meets the same police description. It's from across the room, it's identical. But what I don't have in authenticity, in that Mondrian didn't make it, I have in accessibility. And the best comparison I can make is when you have a pair of $500 Gucci sunglasses and you leave them behind in the restaurant, you turn your car around and you go back and get them. But when you leave your $5 fake Gucci sunglasses that you bought on the street for $5, you just go on with your day. You own them, they don't own you. And the reality is they're both Gucci sunglasses. One's authorized, one isn't. Some might even say they're made in the same factory, I don't know. But, and there are obviously qualitative differences, but I think it's important to recognize that authenticity has many forms, and sometimes adding your own layer of authenticity, rather than subscribing to the pre-existing notion of what authenticity means, can be more valuable, and in fact be a more authentic experience. And for me, in this case, making it was the value, not owning it. But I'm a greedy, greedy man, and this is Toyon's Jr. It's a 7,500 watt boombox. It's based on the sound systems of Jamaica, where he who has the best sound system has the best party. And I love that, but I decided it wasn't big enough, so I made a 10,000 watt version of it. You can see this in Austin at the Contemporary. That's one of the main pieces in the show. It was also part of an exhibition at the Deutsche Guggenheim called Nutsies, and here it is with the Barcelona Pavilion. And those are homemade Barcelona chairs made out of foam core paper and steel. And they're very uncomfortable. But I'd say they're just about as uncomfortable as the original Mies van der Rohe designs. They're harder, but they offer more support. My greed and ambition are not limited to things, but also include real estate. And this is a model of Le Corbusier's Unité de Habitation de Marseille. To me, Le Corbusier is the second most important artist of the 20th century. He revolutionized housing, not really celebrated in the United States, but people like Tadao Ando are clearly his disciples. And without getting too much into Le Corbusier, I'll just say that I'm a fan. And this model of Unité is the same exact dimensions as that boombox. We made them to match, and that was part of a 2001 to 2003 project called Nutsy's World. And in Nutsy's World, we had a great comparison between Le Corbusier and Ray Kroc, the inventor of McDonald's, and the the main idea was the success and failure of modernism, and the terrible irony that Le Corbusier represents the failure of modernism, and Ray Kroc and McDonald's represent his its success. And I love and hate McDonald's. I'm very confused and perplexed by it endlessly. It's nothing's worse for our planet and our bodies, yet no one has fed more people and killed fewer people at the same time. So I don't really know how to reconcile all that, but that's great that I don't have to decide about what's going to happen in Israel. I just get to make my sculpture, and I can be firmly undecided. And that's the advantage that the artist has over politics and industry. But we'll get more to that later. This McDonald's has everything. There's a great movie on. If you want to watch all the movies that I've made, they're all online at www.10bullets.com. I encourage you to go there. My greed isn't even limited to Earth. It includes the solar system. And in 2007, we went to the moon at Gagosian Gallery. What we didn't have in rockets, we used FM static at Mission Control. There's a picture of our Mission Control system. That's actually at the Armory. These are our astronauts. Everything's homemade here. These suits are made of Tyvek. And in fact, how about if I play a little trailer for the movie? You guys want to see that? It's not as dramatic as that. That's called advertising. It has nothing to do with the movie. But I don't think it's important to... I think it's much more important that we don't let truth get in the way of telling a good story. Here we are at Mission Control. This is one of our special effects, how our rockets lift off. And on the telescreen, you'll see on the far right the detail, or on the left. Women's first steps on the surface of the moon, securing the surface. And we're Americans and colonialists. We carry shotguns. Erecting the flag. Preparing to jackhammer the floor, the Richard Meyer polished concrete floor of the Gagosian Gallery. Collecting samples. Conveying them back. And you can see the in a laundry line conveyor. That's a Samsonite silhouette series. There's some luggage. And you can see the intense amount of condensation in the inside of her helmet. We installed fans inside the helmet. And I actually got to interview Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon. And I was so nervous, you can imagine. The ultimate fanboy moment. And I said, what am I going to ask this guy? And I said, how did you deal with condensation inside of the helmets? And he said, Tom, your space program isn't real. Just cut a hole in the back of the helmet. And he's a super smart, practical guy, right? And so I said, well, Buzz, I'm sorry, but my space program is real. And it's by carrying out the details to extreme degrees, that for us the experience becomes authentic. Because otherwise it's just stagecraft. I can make anything look like anything. You can see the virtuosity of technique that we have here. But if you see these in real life, they're much messier. Because what we're really looking to achieve is an authentic experience. It's sort of like when the martial artist who practices his whole life is on his deathbed and he looks back on his life and he never threw a punch in like the street or in combat. He was a student his whole life. And it's really sort of about the journey. It's not making it actually work. It's about learning all the way. And whether it's a guillotine or McDonald's or the space program, it's about educating myself. That's the greatest gift that my work has given back to me. And like Joseph Beuys said, artists don't have a corner on creativity. I think this philosophy is applicable to any job. Anyway, this is Neil Armstrong in a laboratory in Houston doing the same conveyor technique. And you can see the guys in the background. They're dressed like me. Here's Dave Scott looking at the Genesis rock in a laboratory. So fast forward to Mars. Like I said before, we're colonists, and what we're really trying to do here is turn a profit. And we'll get into this in the movie when you see it. But we decided to grow opium on Mars, and because narcotics are our most lucrative trade commodity. This is a page from the zine about the biology lab. If you look at caption number one is the flower, and we grew opium inside this biology lab, opium poppies from bagels that we scraped off the bagel seeds, and pumped that chamber filled with CO2 because Mars has an abundance of CO2 and plants love CO2. They produce oxygen, but they don't need it to grow. And then number two is the bulb becomes engorged with opium latex. Number three, we score it. Number four, we harvest the opium latex. And here on the right, you'll see this pump system. Of course, it's a felony to harvest the opium latex. You can grow the plants, but it's a felony to harvest them, so we didn't really want to get anyone at the Park Avenue Armory in trouble, so we used ivory soap as our simulant, which is also used in adult film to simulate ejaculate. Each bulb and the average male ejaculate is 5 centiliters. Also, Marilyn Chambers, the star behind the Green Door adult film, was also the Ivory Snow Girl. And I grew up in this town called Westport, Connecticut, and she was from Westport. So she was this great source of local pride or shame, depending on your perspective. And we were talking in the car today, Dakin and I, and Dakin reminded me that Marilyn, like Ivory Snow, is 99.44% pure. So we had some great conversations about what the other fraction of 1% was. But we use the opium latex that we rename as there's the harvest picture. And we collect it. We use it in the ritual hand washing that precedes any sort of important religion. All the major religions of the world have a purification ritual. And we use ours in the tea ceremony. And the tea ceremony is one of the few things that we bring to Mars. It's important that you, when you're a scientist, that you scrub your spaceship so you don't contaminate the surface because you're trying to find life. We're Americans, so we bring the noise. We bring boomboxes, and we bring germs, and we bring shotguns, and we're going to actually bring culture. And to me, the best culture of Earth is the tea ceremony. And it's a complex ritual. My aunt, who's in the religion industry, reminded me when I was bragging that I had found a religion that I could finally relate to, I was bragging that I was kind of studying Zen and the tea ceremony. She reminded me that it's not a religion, but it's a philosophy. So again, I'm left out. But here is here are a few scenes from the tea ceremony. This is called Shiburu, the portable use of the brazier in springtime. And it's unpacked, and the astronauts prepare tea. There you can see all the major components. I'm just going to show you a couple of them. There's the sweet in the tea ceremony. Very sweet. Here is a Yoda Paz. There's a whisk. And you can see it. I don't know if anyone has anyone done tea ceremony or drinks matcha or something. You know, it takes, you whisk the bowl with a little bamboo whisk, and they say it takes 5,000 attempts to make one perfect bowl, which if you do the math, it's basically your entire life and you never get perfect. But we motorize the whisk with a little espresso milk frother, and that makes it sort of 80% as good. It's not just good, it's good enough. A little bit of embarrassing detail during the space program. I did not make the tea bowl. In fact, I'm just going to go back and show you this commercial piece of crap that I bought that you can see, not very good detail. Anyway, I felt so guilty about it that I studied with the great J.J. Pete, and he taught me how to make tea bowls, and I went to the 92nd Street Y and learned. And I've been kind of obsessing. I'm just gonna go back for a second and show you that I've made a few more. And then I kind of got really into it, and then I decided to make a few more. That's sort of like half the presentation right there that I would like to show. And I want to just skip ahead to a couple of other sculptures that aren't space program related, but relate to the issues that are near and dear to my heart. Why make sculptures? Besides the rituals, besides authenticity, besides storytelling, I'm interested in sometimes in the history of art, and I'm also interested in process. When I lived in Los Angeles after college, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to make art after I had spent years making sculptures like David Smith, and I had worked as an industrial model maker, and I'd studied architecture, and I was really confused. And I looked at conceptual art, because conceptual art has great rules. I think of Douglas Hubler or Saul LeWitt, or even Bruce Nauman. They moved to California, which is the end of Western civilization, and they're trying to figure out how, you know, after California, you've got Japan, and they're confronted with how to make art against all the possibilities. You've got Hollywood, which breaks the laws of reality and it's fantasy, or you've got the military, you've got the space program, you've got Lockheed Skunk Works, and that break the laws of physics, that break the sound barrier, that break the laws of economics because things are so expensive. And these guys, John Baldessari is another one, set up these incredible rules in which they're going to make art. And at the time, I had a nearly autistic relationship with plywood, and I didn't have a car, and I was looking for a car, and I was trying to figure out what kind of car do I get, and how's the car that I get going to transport a 3/4-inch AC fir piece of plywood that's 4 feet by 8 feet, which is the building standard. And so I thought, okay, how am I, you know, I'm going to look at a full-size van or a Honda Civic wagon, and how's that all going to work? And so I thought of this piece, 4 by 8 sheet of plywood, largest cuboid with no waste. And this sculpture is the biggest cube-like shape, not exactly a cube, that you can make without wasting any wood. And I even measured the kerf of the saw blade and did the calculations so there was no waste. And I vacuumed the table saw out before and collected the all the sawdust and bagged it up like it was precious cocaine and put it in a Zero Halliburton briefcase and saved that and somewhere in storage. And but like a lot of conceptual art, I was always also interested in what's the product of it. And I, if you look at Douglas Hubler or Chris Burden, who I still consider a conceptual artist because he sets out so many great rules and then knocks them down, what's all that's left is a black and white photograph of the experience. But as a greedy consumerist, I wanted something that was concrete, and I have a tremendous sense of responsibility. If you're going to make something and add it to this world, it's got to be beautiful. And to me, this is beautiful and pure. It's a perfect object. It's sort of like even better than Donald Judd. And also because I was working for a carpenter, and he said clients don't like to see end grain. Always avoid the end grain. So I'm like, okay, boss, I'm going to make an all end grain piece. You know, you have to resist. This is a Sub-Zero refrigerator. But it's a model of a Sub-Zero refrigerator on all sides. And again, it could almost be a Donald Judd, but it doesn't open. But again, it's sort of like the same thing as my dad's camera or the Mondrian. It's sympathetic magic. You know, build it and they will come. This to me was always the symbol of ultimate affluence in New York City. The empty Sub-Zero refrigerator with a bottle of Stoli and a pint of Haagen-Dazs, like American Psycho style, perfect. And eventually, a dozen years later, I bought one of those stupid gas guzzling refrigerators, and never again. But they're still the most beautiful. So this is a Donald Judd made out of IKEA. Every day in every city, many, many tons of IKEA are thrown out. IKEA is the fourth largest wood consumer on the planet. I decided that I was going to make one piece of IKEA last forever. So I took it and assembled it into a shape of a Donald Judd chair and reinforced it with carbon fiber. I think I'm the only idiot that's ever combined carbon fiber and particle board. And this is the result. And you can see those stripes are not decorative. Those are tessellated scraps of IKEA put together. I sort of took this scrap material and reconstituted it as if it was very, very precious to me. And in fact, if you look at all the sculptures that you've seen tonight, you'll always see that the wood is painted first and then cut. That's a vestige from me using materials from dumpsters and the beginning of my career when that was my best resource. But it's also a way of communicating the evidence that I was here. The advantage that the artist has over industry is her fingerprints. Like, Apple could never make anything as shitty as this. And I could never make anything as perfect as this on my own. So we have to take that advantage and avoid things like the digital printer or the CNC mill. I mean, they're great tools, but as an individual, we have to take advantage of make things that are here, that are expressions of our now. You know, when I push my finger into a piece of porcelain, it's there for 5,000 years. That's an incredibly long-lasting material. When this building is totally gone, those cups will still be there. And because steel and wood can't last that long. I mean, the things that we have from the ancients are things that are made of stone. This is a cooler from the supermarket. The title is 10,000 Years because this cooler that you use for one day to bring a six-pack of beer to the beach and you throw away, they say that foam lasts for many, many years. Someone said 10,000 years, although those things deteriorate really quickly. I don't know where that came from. But the idea of a single-use refrigeration device or insulation device is so horrible to all of us. But I thought, okay, this one is going to last 10,000 years. This one cooler that I bought for $5. So I coated it with West Systems epoxy and fiberglass. I put an English made gas spring in it. If you look closely, there's a Chanel logo in it. That's pretty messy, but the idea here is putting everything within my power to make this one cooler last 10,000 years. And, you know, infusing it with the pretension and complexity of the art community and the support that I have to build these things, and the sort of enthusiasm of many people around me is to make this one cooler last longer. My mom once said, Tommy, when you die, if your art's really messy, they're going to throw it away. And I think it was because I had all this juvenilia in the rafters above the garage, and she wanted me to get rid of it. It was and I think about Joseph Boys. I hear stories of people throwing Joseph Boys away, like some sausage, and the person cleaning up the house throws it away because it looks disgusting. And it happens. So this is my attempt at doing that. I think I failed because West Systems has that really visceral, organic quality. It should be painted and flawless. But again, you have to make these trade-offs between telling the story of how it's made and hiding that. If we paint it, then it's gone forever, the fingerprints and the drips. Okay, so the ultimate handbag. There's this expression in German, and if someone speaks German, please yell it out. And the word is something like, don't get a Carrera too young so that you have something to look forward to. Do you know that expression? Like the idea of suspending or postponing gratification. So the Kelly bag is the ultimate handbag. So, you know, don't get it too young. Wait. Because it's really an old lady's handbag, and when you see young girls get it, what happens is they don't stop, and they have to get more of them. And it really is the ultimate handbag. So I made one out of plywood, mainly because I can't carry a Kelly bag, not because I can't afford one, but because I'm just not that kind of guy. So... all right, there it is. I did this residency at Jet Propulsion Laboratory during the space program, and they have this ultimate tape dispenser, this 3M tape dispenser, and if you ever want to torture yourself, do we have any sculptors in the room or people that make furniture or things on their own? Okay, that's a lot of people. I know you're being shy, but I can see. Okay, you got more of them. One thing I would discourage you is don't try and make a tape dispenser from scratch. Because here is the from scratch tape cutting blade made, and that's like my sixth try. You can see it's been screwed on and removed a couple times. Those are Ook brand tungsten nails that are to tear the tape, and it's very, very difficult to get a tape tearing blade that won't cut you but will cut the tape consistently, that works right-handed and left-handed. I'm just going to keep making you look at this for a while because I love it so much. Okay. So, all right. One arc worth considering when we look at Barbie slave ship is that the space program is built on African blood. It's quite serious, even though it's a hilarious title, that if you understand the arc of the U.S. going to the moon, beating the Russians by having better German scientists than the Russians did to defeat them in the space race, and also building the Americans with incredible industrial might that's never been surpassed, of building airplanes and submarines faster than they could be blown up by Nazis. If you go back even further and you look, how did this industrial might happen? Well, it was built on cotton, on the slaves who grew cotton and gave the United States an industrial advantage over England, and allowed the United States to gain financial economic independence. There are a lot of different ways of looking at history, and I'm sorry it's a little clumsy the way I told that, but it's important to understand the greatest invention of the American, the greatest cultural invention of the American experience is going to the moon, or jazz. But but both of them are built on Africa and in different ways. And they're really both of the spirit, because the space race was a propaganda thing. And I would say it's almost like the greatest art piece of all time, in that it was a military scale operation done for folly or for emotional warfare. It was a way of showing intimidation, and incredibly we succeeded and went to the moon and killed God. And Barbie Slave Ship, which is a model of HMS Victory, but it's got 144 guns, and it's got Barbies laid out in the same pattern as the Brooks diagram. And here I've got 324 women. These are the women of my life. If you could ask me, Tom, if you could make up yourself as a list of women, who would they be? That's what this painting is. I'm just going to zoom in so you can see. No particular order. Some of them are people that are personal, but there's the Brooks diagram. Brooks diagram, for those of you who don't know, was a piece of abolitionist propaganda that helped northern liberals understand what was going on in the trade triangle between the New World, Europe, and Africa, and in particular, this part of it, the Middle Passage, where there was 20% mortality for cargo and crew. On a lighter note, this is Plywood Barbie. And this is kind of a model of my wife. Everyone wants to be Barbie or fuck Barbie. And when I was a kid, my parents were terrified that I was playing with my sister's Barbie so much that I would turn out to be gay when I grew up, and so they encouraged carpentry, and I took my sister's Barbie into the basement and carved her out of plywood. This is a later version. This is as me as an adult. I carved her out of plywood because they wouldn't buy me my own Barbie, and they realized after a while that it wasn't love; it was only lust. And this is my African American Express card. It's a titanium Amex card that is used by pretentious affluent men to impress strippers. And I got one and made it into a cocaine cleaver. So this is a stupa, Japanese stupa, that's a part of the tea ceremony, the tea tradition. This was, this is made out of plywood and epoxy. And again, I'm showing this to you so that you can somehow imagine this in the modernist tradition, even though it's kind of an ancient Chinese form, as taken through the filter of the Japanese eye. But it's made of plywood and epoxy resin, and you can see the drips. And if you go up to Austin and to the Laguna Gloria, you'll see a cardboard version of this that's been made in bronze, that's in the sculpture garden there. This is the McDonald's fry shovel. Who's worked in a restaurant? in my studio, by the way, we've got a team of 10 people, and the only prerequisite that we have is that you have to have worked in a restaurant. And I say that because a lot of us have, and it's kind of it's a tough job. There's no job in a restaurant that isn't tough in some way, and it builds character. And I don't want to teach that. I want to benefit from some other boss's struggle of breaking someone down and building them back up. This is the fry shovel, and it's to me, it could be a piece of African sculpture or a, I don't know. It has, it, of course, there's a utility there, although I'm not so sure how hygienic it is because it's rusty and kind of nasty, but it works, and we use that in our own homemade McDonald's. It's great not having to worry about health code violations. This is another kind of weird sculpture. It's called Tsukebe, which means something like dirty old man in Japanese, and they're used originally in geriatric homes for bathing people, but they've become popular in Japanese bathhouses as a sex fetish. And so the man sits on it and his genitals are washed. I added the holes so that you could have, while your balls were being washed, they could also be watched. And but, you know, maybe I'm a little pretentious because I'm not obsessively into that kind of activity, although it sounds nice. I think for me, it was a way of, you know, when I read about that, I thought it was so kinky and weird and interesting in that kind of Google way that you can go to paths of your minds. But also the form of this, I thought it could be some kind of modern artist. I don't know. I thought the plywood detailing, and you can see the resin and the cardboard of the curve. I don't really know how to describe it. I mean, sometimes I think I should have made those holes a little bigger. But it's a clear expression of my life, and it's a mailing tube from McMaster Car, which is the church of all makers, the catalog being the Bible. I'm not exactly sure. I'm just this last batch of pictures, what I'm really trying to build is an association of formal qualities where these everyday objects relate to each other or relate to themselves in a language that is I don't know, reminds me of sculpture. This is not just any old Tsukebe chair. This is a specific one that has an arc that has where the corner looks like it's penetrating the hole from in this particular photograph, where you can see the laminates and the curve and how it floats off the ground. These are all things that I learned from looking at David Smith and Alexander Calder. We're kind of almost at the end here, and this is these are my favorite tools in a McDonald's fry cup, and my favorite glasses, and my mom's scissors, and the necktie that I'm wearing wrapped around my balls. And those are steel balls in a Vectran scrotal sack that is, Vectran is a material that my shoes are made out of. It's the airbags that were used on the MER landers, like Spirit and Opportunity at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And some of my friends there gave me that material. It's very, very strong yet brittle material. I think this is an art piece about my relationship between my work and my home life. And that on one side there's a stranglehold, and the other side there's the head filled with ideas or the means to execute them. And each one of those, I have a story we could talk endlessly about, but I'm very particular about my favorite hand tools. And it was a great honor to be able to sacrifice a pair of Mitutoyo digital calipers and weld them into the sculpture. I felt great honor in that. Yeah, the sacrifice. So I mean, that's just a porcelain cane. That's kind of like, I think a lot of artists could have made that. That's why I skipped over it, but it's kind of worth showing. it's held together. It's those are Kevlar and epoxy little joints. I'm not going to kid you. Fiberglass works just as well as Kevlar, but you don't get to say that it's made out of Kevlar. And I think that's important bragging rights. But it's also, it is more yellow. And the thing about West Systems epoxy is that it does yellow, and it's not very consistent for as an art material because it does change over time. I don't think it has inherent vice, but the color shift is completely unpredictable. And I mean, those could turn red eventually, but by introducing the Kevlar strips, I kind of embrace that. It accelerates it, and it's already dark and it's rich. And of course, you make a walking stick or a cane out of porcelain, you're asking for trouble. The final image is what's in the tokonoma of the tea garden. The tea house. Every tea house has a little shrine, and the shrine usually has a scroll. And the great Senno Rikyu, who is the Muhammad Ali of tea ceremonies, said that the tokonoma or the shrine, the scroll that's in the tokonoma, is the way that the host communicates to the guest best. It's his way of saying whatever he's trying to communicate, whether it's about the weather or about the time of year or something political. So I almost always put a cinder block in my tokonoma, whether it's a cinder block that I buy or one that I make out of plywood. It's the symbol of architecture when you colonize a new place, you arrive with your Bible and shotgun, you knock down all the round buildings, you set up a cinder block factory so you can make occidental rectangular buildings, and it's the symbol of my space program. In fact, I have just a couple of stickers here for the people who ask the best questions. Get them. It's a good solution, right? So when we build our space station, we build it with cinder blocks. So I want to thank you for listening, and I'm here as long as you like to ask questions, and I've got more images we can jump back or to, we can go inside to more images that are like the ones that you saw. So thanks. Colin.
So in the middle of his lecture, he said that he thought maybe the second most important artist of the 20th century was Le Corbusier. So I'm wondering, who do you think the first most?
Okay, does anyone know the answer to this? Shout it out. Mondrian? No way. Judd? No way, come on. Wrong color. No, Warhol, absolutely not. Okay, the correct answer and the only acceptable answer is Louis Armstrong. I mean, he invented the solo. He's the key figure in American music. He's the guy. And without Louis Armstrong, you don't have Frank Ocean. You know, and everyone in between. And the book to read about, and the reason why the book to read is Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans. If you have any questions, it's all in there.
What did you say when you said sympathetic something? You said
sympathetic magic.
Sympathetic magic. That's a beautiful term. Did you borrow that or did you make it up?
So, you know, sympathetic magic is an Aboriginal term. It's sort of like voodoo. You build a model of your enemy's fort and you burn it down as a way of actualizing your desires. Or an ex voto, you have a busted arm, you make a model of it, you bring it to your church and the priest prays to it, and you're creating positive thought. It's an essential part of healing process. If you believe you will heal, you will heal. If you believe you will survive, you will survive. And if you don't, you're dead anyway. I mean, this stuff really works. It's sort of the idea of believing in yourself. And everything I've made here in my life has been because I wanted it, whether it was a stupid, greedy thing like a painting or just being able to make stuff every day. And that's what I have the best job in the whole world. I get to make stuff. And I make what I want, and I don't take commissions, and I would do it for nothing. And so I feel really blessed that I get to do that. And this is something that I had a very clear vision of in my early 20s, that I wanted to make things for the rest of my life. Even though I didn't really know how to do it, I just enjoyed it. So I organized to put all of my eggs in this one basket of, I want to make stuff. And, you know, there's an even better anthropological term called cargo cult. And this was a thing that happened after World War II. Anthropologists went to places like New Guinea, and the locals would worship the anthropologists' refrigerators, and they'd make little boxes out of wood because food came out of them. And they make models of airplanes. And the anthropologist said, you know, they would say, how do we get those planes to bring more things? How do we get them to land? How do we get the boats to come here? And the anthropologist said, well, you know, they won't land here because they need a runway. And they're like, what's a runway? And they're like, okay, so we're going to, you know, it's a flat area. So they said, okay, we'll make a runway, we'll make a dock, even though we don't even really know what they are. And of course, anthropologists came to look at the docks and runways. And what did they bring? They brought iron axes and that were better than the Stone Age axes that the local guys had. But it wasn't exactly the way they planned it. I mean, it's not my career of making stuff isn't exactly, I didn't design it like that. I just had kind of a rough idea. I mean, you can't control everything, but if you put your mind in motion towards your desires and literally put all of your eggs in one basket and do not worry about the consequences and take care of the luxuries because the necessities will take care of themselves. I mean, you're not going to die. You just have to believe in it. Then your life experience will bring the things that are important to you.
That's fantastic.
Has your work gotten near or dirtier because of your mother's advice?
Sorry?
Because of your mother's advice, has your work gotten near or dirtier?
That's a tough question. Neater. Much neater. But I blame not my mother. I blame not my mother, but the guys at Barney's New York, who were window display guys, who were much tougher when all my friends went to grad school. And by the way, you shouldn't go to grad school for art. Just don't do it. You're only allowed, I mean, I'm the guy with the mic, so I can say this. You're only allowed to go to graduate school for a vocational thing, like air conditioning, refrigeration, law. It's really much better to, you know, you need a law degree or medicine. You can do it without a degree, but I would avoid business school. Just if you want to learn about business, start a business. If you want to be an artist, make art. And again, the pieces will fall into place. But if you want to learn about air conditioning, refrigeration, or medicine, go to school and talk to people who know how to do it, because there's a lot of technical stuff in there. but someone here had a question that was interrupted. Is that okay?
I have a question about your zines. Yes. You see, I love them, and I was just curious about how the zines, so like what role they play in your studio practice.
Yeah, so zine is a short for magazine or fanzine, and they're homemade books that are made traditionally on mimeographs or photocopiers, but now the world's changed, so we have digital printing. I make a zine for every single exhibition that I do. There's a very short-run zine for the exhibition at Laura Reynolds Gallery that's very small. It's a small exhibition, although the works are big. And Barbie and African American Express are in that show. I do that as a way of sharing. So the fanzine, which was brought into my life through my experience in punk rock culture. Small bands would travel around the country in little vans, and we didn't have websites, so they'd bring little magazines and trade them or give them away, and that's sort of where it comes from in my life. But I do that now, and I give away a lot of zines. I didn't bring any for you tonight. I brought stickers, which is kind of another form of commerce. But I think that they're important because they were sort of displaced by websites. Websites work much better. You reach more people. But I've noticed that zines have had a big return in the past few years. People are bringing it back. I don't know if it's like a nostalgic vinyl hipster thing, or if it's just because it's sometimes nice to hold something and to actually physically make something. And although I believe my website works better than a zine, it's not as tactile. We sell the zines on the website. I would like to give them away, but I do. But the way we just have things on the website is a way of allowing people to get them. Because sometimes if you leave pamphlets or zines out, people don't appreciate them. It's a terrible, the perception of abundance creates a disdain for resources. And so we have to respect human nature in that way.
So you talked about growing up in a family that's kind of more consumerist and your greed and desire for these material things.
Yeah.
But I'm curious how you came to be interested in Zen and some of the teachings that are kind of counter to what so much of your work is kind of.
Well, first of all, I have to apologize to my parents because I sound like they grew up in this terrible household. But they were very loving and supportive and philosophical about it all. It was just the community that we grew up in. And I feel that I am I feel particularly authorized to speak on the subject of consumerism as an active participant. I'm not a critic. I'm part of it. I mean, look at all my expensive shit I'm wearing. And I don't hold back. I have a new phone. I don't like talking about Zen too much because it's really like it's kind of douchey, this isn't wabi-sabi enough, that kind of thing. I don't want to be that guy, but I know that. And we don't even really have Zen in America. We've got the zone. Right? Like, and when I'm making plywood, imagine making this, and there's some technical virtuosity to that sculpture. It's kind of impressive, hard just to get everything just right and just wrong in the same way. That's when I'm in the zone, and when I'm building in plywood or cardboard or metal and mixed media, that's when I'm like Michael Jordan. that's my area where I'm like a black belt, is actually physically making the stuff or making those bowls, even though I'm kind of new at it and bad at it. That I get into that meditative state. And actually the tea ceremony for me, I'm not really good at getting zenned out and drinking a bowl of mud, but I am at making all the accoutrements for it. So everyone has their place in society. I'm not James Bond. I'm Q, the guy who makes the guns and the cars and all that. And I think what's important really is that you find a place that you feel comfortable and that you understand yourself and who you are so that and accept who you are so that you can, have the courage to make just the right wrong decision. Trust your gut. I've used psychotherapy and meditation as a way of understanding myself a little bit better, but the most therapeutic thing that I do is the work itself. And in school we learn 1 + 1 = 1,000,000, but in the studio we learn 1 + 1 = 2, but in the studio we learn that it equals 1,000,000, and it's just choosing the right wrong two things. And in the right way. And I'm not going to pretend that taste and style don't count. They do. It's not just the idea. If you look at all the conceptual artists, they all have different style and taste, and some of them are better than others. And we might not agree on which ones those are. Some of us might love the ones that have great ideas. Others might like the ones that have better deadpan presentation. Okay.
What are you reading right now?
I just finished. I don't know if I want to read it because I don't know if it's good enough to talk about, but I just finished The Martian.
Yeah.
Who's read The Martian? Engineering core, right? It's unbelievable. It's I'm reading that, and I'm also rereading. I just got, so that's the one, is Val Ben's, what's it called again? Dakin, what was it? Val Ben's, can't remember what the title of it. It's like an 1850 critique of consumer culture.
Theory of the Leisure Class.
Thank you. Just get it. Just look at the table of contents. Right? So nothing's changed. That's a good one.
That's fantastic.
I saw your plywood film in Austin. It's a contemporary, and
yes.
You know, obviously you're very fascinated with both ritual and process, but how there seemed to be a real strong discipline on how you treat plywood. You have to paint it first and do the way you treat the edges, the paint. I don't know if you really buy the China kind of hardware, but you do. But how is your 10 people, how is it set up? Is it a McDonald's in terms of everybody has very specific roles? Is it?
We're more like
discipline. Do you have all these rules are written down?
It's not like McDonald's, it's more like the Israeli army. Where everyone does everything. Or like the guy at the bottom of the totem pole went to enough military school that he could command everyone else in case everyone gets blown up. One of the horrible things about the modern age is that craft has been broken down into all the components. So that's the way, that's the road to efficiency. But we don't do that. Like someone takes the project all the way through from the beginning to end, or we all, you know, attack it as a gang, depending on what the project is. Love Letter to Plywood is our training manual for how materials are to be dealt with, and it's very idiosyncratic. But the studio is a teaching hospital, and there are people on my team that have less skill than me, and there are people on my team that have more skill. And what's really important is that things not be done the right way, but they be done my way. So that, because there are plenty of carpenters who can build this podium perfectly, but there are very few that can build them exactly the way I do. And it's important that I enhance the idiosyncrasies of the way I make things. Like if you look at this cinder block, you'll see the screws, and it would be very easy for me to epoxy over and repaint over them. It would be very easy for me to stain the epoxy meniscus or whatever that corn, so that it matched the gray of the concrete. It's not concrete, it's gray paint to look like concrete. Or it's not even concrete, it's cinder, whatever that cinder block material is. And to find the language that speaks, that made it look like I made it. And I'm not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes and say that, you know, I made this or someone from my team made it. To me, there's no distinction. People hate that. They want that. Oh, did you make this one, Tom? And I draw no distinction. I think the exceptions are things like drawing. Or the first gesture always has to be mine. I mean, for example, like these, see the three dots on the bottom there? Those were where the screws originally were, and then I moved them, and but we have the vestige of that. Now, of course, the second one isn't going to be as good because it's not going to have those three dots, and I would never artificially put those three dots in there. I think the code is because when you do something like make a landing module, out of plywood. That's something I can't do by myself because it's too big and I have a space program to run. I mean, because I have the same problems that Elon Musk or Obama have with their space programs. Because we have fundraising and safety concerns and public relations, and I'm the sort of the flight director. That's one of the reasons why my astronauts are women, is because I can't go. So I'm going to send someone that represents the studio. And the reason we choose women is because we honor Ann Lee, the mother Ann Lee, the leader and inventor of the Shakers, who invented the circular saw and the flat broom. You ever try sweeping with a round broom? Okay, in the back.
What advice would you give to young artists about graduating?
Young artists what?
What advice would you give to young artists about graduating?
Young artists about to graduate.
Well, I like the idea of just making sure that you are passionate about what you do. That you really go all the way and don't hold back. And when you're afraid of something, be afraid to do it anyway. You're always going to be afraid of, oh, I'm going to be broke, I'm not going to have the money. But you gotta just work hard. They say, bravery is just ignoring fear. And fear is a good thing because, fire will burn your skin. So I think maybe it's...
it's time.
I think maybe one last question and I think we're done.
What I really enjoyed is so much of your work kind of has an endless sense of curiosity. It almost feels like a little girl going through Granny's closet. And so I wanted to ask you, do you feel like you've grown up at all?
And I hope not. Again, the greatest luxury of my life is that I get to stay a student my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to... I mean, skateboarding is really hard. I'm 48 years old, and I don't heal as fast. So I do other, I ride my bike now. I think it's important to keep curious. I think youth is a frame of mind and an attitude, and it has a lot to do with fear. And I spend a lot of time thinking about my fears. I think we'll all be afraid to the end of our lives, and when people talk about fear, they deny it and pretend like they're not afraid. It has to be there, otherwise we're dead. But it's essential if you're going to make great art that you live a great life, and that you approach your fears with... confidence, with your intellect and with your gut feeling, and really just do it anyway. So thank you.
Yes.